Hello and welcome to the GWL at 30 podcast series. Developed and recorded by volunteers, this podcast sheds light on our history and celebrates our 30 years of work across six main themes: accessibility, green, LGBTQ+, anti-racism, violence against women, and changemaking. This episode focuses on our green and environmental work. Our volunteers chat to some of our collections, curation and programming staff members to discuss how green work is embedded in all areas of GWL.
Welcome to this GWL podcast on green issues at the library. I'm Joy, I've been a member of the library since the 90s and volunteering for the last few years.
I'm Neve and I've been volunteering at the library since December 2022.
And I'm Caroline, and I work in the library as the development worker for programme curating partnerships and participation.
And I'm Jenny, I'm the museum curator at Hilt Women's Library, and I've been here since towards the end of 2017.
So, Caroline, we talk about green issues, and it's a useful shorthand that we all understand, but maybe the word sometimes risks obscuring the broader issues that are so important, like social justice, consumerism. Can you say a little bit about that broader green worldview and other connected issues that we should all bear in mind?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this before, we were chatting about it, and I think, Joy, you said it was pretty insightful that you said, yeah, is green the word? And I hadn't even really thought of that, but I think, you know, and for us at the library, like in our core values, I think people recognise us for the kind of like equalities and social justice work and like primarily, but you know, green work has always run through what we do as well, and I think part of that is because of the interconnectedness of everything. So green work is social justice work on a local scale and on a global scale. I guess the people who are suffering the most from climate change globally are the ones who've contributed to at least, so it's a justice issue. But yeah, also I think when you scale that down and look locally as well, working class communities also contribute less, and you'll find that they might be cited in areas that are not so good for their health, or so like all of these things kind of intersect in terms of our environment and like who's located in the best environments and who's doing the most damage and all of those things. So I guess I'd say that there are other things going on there, and as soon as you start to talk about that, of course, you have to kind of factor in colonialism and those legacies. So, yeah, we did a really interesting project with, I'm probably getting ahead of myself, we did a project with an artist called Annalie Davis who was looking at plantations and plantation economies and monocrops and, you know, how the damage that's doing. And then, of course, you're folding in farming and mono agriculture and how that has kind of come out of colonialism. And you know, she was also looking at how to rewild those sites and what enslaved communities did on those sites, use the biodiversity of places to kind of heal themselves and things. So yes, all these things are kind of interconnected, and that's before even talking about capitalism, which I can see is on my list as well, but we'll probably get into that. Yeah, I mean, I guess the other thing I would say on it is that when people think about green issues, I think there's kind of a tendency to think, you know, we're facing this looming thing in the future, and we'll have to think up like all these smart new technologies and solutions and things. But like, we have a lot of the things in place and that have been removed that are like green systems that you don't necessarily kind of identify as green systems. So a library is a circular economy, it is a green system, but I'm not sure many people, if you ask them to kind of like identify a green technology, they would be like, a library. So I think that, you know, there's some, and I guess that's where we're thinking about, you know, sort of other economies than capitalism, like other kind of sharing, reusing, circular methods of being together.
Yeah, so looking back a little bit to the early days, the library obviously was already green then, And that was partly because that chimed with its values, the values it's always had. It was partly, though, because there was simply a lack of resources, so things had to be donated, things had to be recycled. Now, obviously, both of you are far too young to have been there right from the beginning of the library, but you have been working on the three-decade project, which obviously has given us a really good idea of the evolution of the library. So maybe you'd like to say a little bit about how being green over the years has perhaps become more embedded, more mainstreamed in the library, and what the three-decade project maybe tells us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the three-decades project, it really brought home the history and the evolution of the library, starting as a, broadly speaking, a women's arts collective. And I think, yeah, you mentioned the values, and Carolyn did as well, and those have been instilled from the beginning, and I think that's really important. It's an organisation that, right from its inception, has railed against some of the power injustices that you referred to in the first question, Caroline. So I think just being an intersectional feminist activist organisation in the first place is very much aligned to the Green Movement. So that's kind of the wider context that allows you to plant those seeds of change, if you like. And just going through some like the programmes and newsletters from the early days, it's just amazing what was going on. So you mentioned lack of resources, but there was no lack of resourcefulness. Like, that was just in abundance, creativity and collaboration. So just finding ways to make things and share things and communicate things cheaply but creatively, I think, was really key. Reusing things and recycling things. So just basics, if you like, in the context of greenness, but something that had to be done, but also I think is good to still be doing. And then the library, it's always had a tradition of lifelong learning. So when you look back through some of the programmes, for example, I was looking at a project called Bright Green Living, which was from 2003, and that was in the days when the library had its own allotment plot. It was a community garden which encouraged women from all walks of life to get involved and just to enjoy engaging with nature, as well as learning practicalities of having a fruit and veg plot and just being out of doors and appreciating that. And throughout the 2000s, in fact, there seems to have been a lot of different projects that allowed women to engage with nature in different ways. So from creative writing workshops to using flowers as inspiration for pure joy, but also the sort of focusing on the practical, how to maintain a garden. I think that's just sort of interwoven through a lot of the lifelong learning programme that I've seen. And we've moved several times, Glasgow Women's Library, so that obviously has had an impact on things like, you know, where it's possible to have an allotment plot or a garden. But since moving to Bridgeton, even here, we've got our own small garden outside the library, and that's extended to Bridgeton train station, where there are planters. And then, of course, we've been implementing our carbon net zero plans moving forward.
So the library has an ambitious plan to carbon net zero by 2030. Carolyn, can you tell us a bit about the process that led to that and where you're currently at with that plan?
So when I guess one of the ways, green things are embedded now is to do with our creative cluster system. So that's shorthand for, like, basically we all work within our jobs, and obviously there's an amazing team of volunteers, and the clusters sort of are a different way to organise people out with their, you know, the things they would do normally around interests and passions. So there's lots of different clusters, but one of them is the green cluster. And when I joined the library, I joined the green cluster, which has been really brilliant. And there was a lot of really good work going on, which is a mixture of super, super practical things. Like, as Jenny said, we moved building. So a lot of the green work is embedded in, like, figuring out how we can make the building as green as possible. So, you know, they'd already sorted out the best kind of suppliers, printing, or from really tiny things to, like, how we reuse the plastic to fill up our hand soaps. We've got little signs, and we work with a designer to have a little kind of green logo for things. So the green cluster were quite busy on a practical level, sort of making sure that all the kind of our footprint was as small as possible in the things we did in the building, but also that we were communicating this. So there was a kind of whole bit about writing blogs, and we've always, you know, as Jenny said, there's always been a lot of events, so sort of communicating our green aspirations as well. And the final thing was measuring and reporting, which is very important as well, to figure out where we are already. that was sort of where I came into the green cluster, and incredibly well organized, amazing cluster. And I think the cluster was saying, but what now? Because we've done those things, so what now? What is it now? What do we want? And you know, we're really lucky, I think, in the whole of GWL that everybody's really aligned in green aspirations. I've talked about the green cluster, but it's not like, you know, anyone who cares about green stuff is in that cluster. Like, it's everyone cares. So we had a COP was coming to the city, and so we were thinking about that like really carefully, and we were talking to Creative Scotland, who are one of our funders, and Adele sort of said, you know, we want to be really ambitious, we want to be announcing something really ambitious. And I guess it was in the time that governments are saying we're going to announce a climate emergency, and what we wanted to do was say we're going to be carbon neutral. Like, you know, we're going to say we're going to be carbon neutral by 2030, or I don't know if she gave a date, she might have said by COP, so the green cluster busily went to work on, right, this is what we're doing. And that was a case of kind of getting in touch with Dress for the Weather, who are some architects, some local architects, and who I'd worked with when I was at South Seeds in Govan Hill a little bit, and who look at buildings and look at carbon footprints and things like that, and give you a route plan. So for the green cluster, it was about, like, what are these practical steps? What can we do? We want it laid out so then we know we're going in this direction and this one. So out of that, we commissioned the carbon neutral route plan. So we've launched that. I think last month we launched the carbon neutral route plan, and we've already found it really useful. So we had kind of green councillors in the room there supporting that. So we're looking to be the first museum in the UK to be carbon neutral, which is just huge. So, the plan saying we can do it, and you know, the way they work it out is because we're in an old building. There's kind of embedded, in some ways, by using an old building, it's like, because they measure kind of like the carbon costs of building as well. So we don't have those costs, but you know, we are an old building, so we've got a lot of insulating to do, basically. But having the route plan means we've already been able to give funders, like, you know, give different people who are going to support us to do this exact figures, right? This is how much carbon it's going to save, and this is where we're going to be. But I think I've gone beyond telling you. Mm. But that's, yeah, yeah. That's, but where we are with it.
Good
it's
to mention
exciting.
That we have already, you know, we've installed LED lighting,
yeah,
and there's secondary glazing on the windows. Mm. So already, like, the boiler's been replaced as well, so like, mm-hmm, the gas bill is coming down, and so there's been things that have been addressed sort of shorter term, and then, mm-hmm, there's our medium to long term projects which will take more funding,
mm-hmm,
but there's always like little steps we can do in the meantime. So yeah, it feels like we are moving forward on it, which is good, because it's, yeah, net, mm-hmm, zero by 2030 is the plan.
The plan's keeping us busy. Yeah.
So a lot of work obviously has been done already, and already is being done. What about the costs of doing this work? So that might be monetary, might be other forms of cost. Could you maybe say just a little bit about what it costs to actually do this kind of green work?
Yeah, I mean, this plan, we're calling it our net zero handbook, and there are costings in the handbook. I mean, some of them, we're talking six figures. It's not small amounts. So the insulation, depending on how much the building gets insulated, then it is a lot of money, but it can be broken down into different stages and different, mm, parts of the building. So yeah, so there, I mean, there's a financial cost, and for that we obviously have to look at grant applications, but we've also got our own fundraising projects, like Women on the Wall, which is a lovely scheme to raise money for our green initiatives, but also allows people to put forward women, whether they're like already known or whether they're women who deserve to be known, and to have a place on our library walls. So I think it's a really nice way of like developing the history and heritage of women, you know, whether it's in Glasgow or across Scotland or beyond, while we're working towards our green aims.
And I think, you know, to be positive about it as well, that there are high costs to get the building up to scratch, where it's not using any energy anymore. But there's also really exciting things, as Jenny said, about, you know, the fundraising towards it is doing our heritage work, but also what we're looking at is, by the time we get to the point where we're not using a lot of energy, we're looking at renewables, and we're looking at generating more energy than we need. I think that's sort of like where I feel like it's really in the spirit of the library, because it's, you know, it's a collection that's being built up in collaboration with like countless people over 30 years, and it's all about shared energy. So I think, you know, we're looking at the cost now for like really, really great benefits later on, and I suppose also, yeah, the cost of doing nothing,
yeah, I mean,
much higher.
It is, like, when you look at it that way, it's, like, completely essential work. We're at a point now, it's, you know, called the tipping point, and we're, like, yeah, close to tipping right over. So if we don't do something now, then we're in a much worse position, and, you know, really having to catch up and probably, like, spend even more than if we do it as a part of a plan now, we can, yeah, hopefully encourage others to follow suit. So the cost of doing nothing, I think, is the highest of all.
Can you give us some examples of ways in which the library's seeking to make all its activities green?
Yeah, I mean, I think sustainability is key to a lot of our work. So part of that is making sure that we can identify local organisations to work with, so local suppliers, and also, like, you know, if we have an event, then we tend to focus on veggie or vegan food, refreshments. T-shirts in our shop, we worked with like local designers, and they've been printed on locally on sustainable cotton material. Our mezzanine display cases were sourced by a company just along the road and built by them. Our exhibition panels, we print on paper so that they can be recycled, and they are also printed by a local company. So I think that's kind of one of the starting points, is like not outsourcing where you don't need to, but looking at where you can make local partnerships, collaboration, and sharing resources in some way. And, you know, again, it's that circular economy where, you know, we're supporting a local business and they'll support us, and it keeps going around that way.
Yeah, we look to sort of reuse and recycle, and if we can, in terms of making exhibitions or anything we do, if we're looking to collaborate with other arts organisations, universities, with, you know, a lot of what we do is in partnership. So it's like, where do these resources exist already? And I suppose this is kind of like a long-term feminist learning, because historically feminist organisations haven't had the cash to just be like, right, we'll buy new, we won't think, and, you know, we'll get it from miles away or whatever. So I think, like, we've got all the practices kind of embedded, and, you know, we're always doing that thinking where we can, and maybe we're thinking about building in more time for projects, because I think this is probably back to costs again, but I think time is a cost as well. Like, the longer you can spend to kind of unpack all of those different elements, all of those traces carefully that make up a project, and spend the time sourcing things ethically. Yeah.
You had a nice expression there just earlier, Caroline, where you were talking about the library consuming less energy and at the same time being like a generator and a sharer of energy, which it's a nice kind of connection that you made there. And obviously one of the ways in which energy is generated and shared, it's often through the events that the library organises. So maybe you could give us a bit of a flavour of some of the, if you like, the green initiatives, the green events that the library has hosted.
Yeah, well, actually, I've got a programme here in front of me from spring 2019, and there's a whole section called Women in the Environment, Activism in Our Changing World, and there's a whole host of events and activities that were run. So, for example, Women in the Landscape focused on the history of environmental action, including peace movement and anti-nuclear activism. There's been Story Cafe specials that have focused on women and the environment, and that's included cycling, for example. There was one speaking to Kate Rawls about the carbon cycle, and we have heritage bike rides as well, so that's another way of encouraging women to, public transport is obviously better than, you know, having your own personal transport, but trying to encourage people to walk or cycle is another thing that the library is constantly doing where it's possible for women. There's been writing workshops. Here there's the Secret Garden writing workshop, which sounds lovely, in the Secret Garden in Edinburgh. So it's not just all Glasgow based, it's picking up on places of beauty around Scotland.
So as an accredited museum, GWL hosts major collections. What are the green challenges that you face there? Is digitalisation part of the answer?
I mean, we do digitise our collections, and I think it's really important, particularly for access. I don't know that it's the sole answer, because digital material has got its own carbon footprint, but it's definitely important for preservation and access. And actually, I think that relevance and access is one of the key points that makes our collections, like, that does allow them to be green in some way. It's kind of like the circular economy in a way. It comes back to that our collections are a starting point for discussions and activities and inspiration. So I came across this phrase, education and mobilisation, which is really about using, in our case, the collections to learn, to imagine or reimagine, and then to adapt. And I think that's what's needed for now. And also colonialism, and looking at some of those legacies and how that's impacted on the environment. And to go back to an earlier event, like our Open the Door Festival of Women's Writing in 2020 was also focused on the environment and ecofeminism. So like exploring people like Wangari Maathai, who started the Green Belt movement in Africa, and acknowledging the fact that colonialism has actually stripped away ecological practices that were used until, you know, people like until the British Empire was set up and other Europeans came along and took all that away and took away their collective memories, you know, and put our own practices in place. So I think we have to use the collections to acknowledge how much damage has been done and then look at what's been successful elsewhere. So there's a lot of like examples of good models that can be used in our collections. So I think relevance in the collections and providing access is really key to making sure that they're not just sitting in boxes doing nothing, because I think that's where collections become problematic in terms of environment. You know, they have to be useful. We have to be able to learn from them and to enjoy them as well, but to be able to engage with them.
Yeah, so with such a vast topic, there's always more to do, of course. So what do you think the upcoming challenges are going to be for the library, and what do you see as the strengths that the library has? What can it draw on in order to face those challenges?
So the key, the key challenge that we're all focused on, and this episode's focusing on, is obviously climate change, so that's a big one. it's not just a challenge for the library, it's a challenge for everyone. So, yeah, I guess a lot of that sort of looking at sort of, you know, how we protect the resources we've got, and I guess you could think of that in a really physical way. But I think the things that Jenny has said are really important as well for, like, you know, making sure there's very, very broad access to the things we've got, because there's really important knowledges there. And, you know, also sort of pointing out where gaps and erasures are is part of the work as well. So I think to keep bringing them out and sort of learning from them and relearning those knowledges, or, you know, putting those memories in everybody's consciousness is kind of part of it. These are practices. This is about the past affecting the present, and that's very much like, you know, the strand of work we've got an amazing collection of peace activism, and I think that one example of kind of a thread of work that we've done with peace activists, we just had the Horties in celebrating their 40th anniversary, the Gare Horts Peace Activists group, who were named after planting a peace rose. So they've got that connection with growing things, but I think there's a lot to be learned from peace activism about the way we connect with each other as well, and how we organise and how we mobilise, and, you know, how we kind of can, even though we're small, like, because I think that is one thing we've talked about in terms of resources, like, relatively speaking, we're small, so our footprint is smaller, and we're mobile and nimble. So these are good things. And, you know, just looking at that one example of activists and how they could mobilise, like, before the internet and organise, get lots of people together and have a strong voice. I think that's the sort of thing that we hold knowledge of, and, you know, and confidence in, that we're doing it now, that, you know, we're working collaboratively, and we might be speaking from the margins, but with a big voice, and we know how to do that. And I think that will be needed too, for, like, facing the challenges, because the challenge is climate change, but the challenge is also sort of it is an anti-capitalist struggle as well, isn't it? So
yeah, definitely. So yeah, I think all of that, and you mentioned like, yeah, there could be practical things. So just I think with climate change, we are going to see more storms, we're going to see like heavier rainfalls, we're going to see flooding. So yeah, there's challenges that we have to be able to keep on top of and respond to. I think as a team, like, again, we benefit because we work so well together and we support each other, and I think that's part of the feminist basis of the organisation. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, so for me, it's like the library can draw on our shared core values, and that resourcefulness and creativity that I mentioned earlier on, I think mm-hmm. is like really key to the way we work. And as Caroline said, collaboration and being willing to share what we're doing but also get inspiration from others is a huge thing as well.
So yeah, this work is so important, but the bigger picture can sometimes feel a little overwhelming. So where do you find the inspiration that keeps you going and fuels your imagination for this work?
I mean, I think it's all around us, like little things that you see people doing to, like, you know, just like planting a wee garden of their own just in their own tiny space, to organisations that are like really positing themselves to make a difference. So like Julie's Bicycles are a really great organisation that puts forward a lot of ideas, and they've published a creative climate justice guide, which has got practical tips in it, as well as sort of putting the green issues in context, some of them we've touched on. And we've recently seen the launch of the Creative Degrowth Network Scotland, and there was a wee quote from that I noted down because I really liked it. It's about using culture to tell positive stories and reimagine the future. And I think that's something that we do well at the library and we can keep doing, but also it's about connecting with all these organisations that we're not working on our own, but we can join together to share ideas and also influence change that's meaningful. Yeah, I think it's possible if we can like expand our network, and there's definitely organisations out there that, yeah, have got great ideas. It's just sort of not exploiting them, but working with them and, yeah, sort of transforming the ways that we work, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, as we're doing a podcast, I guess I've got my super practical inspiration point that is a podcast called Mothers of Invention. So that tends to have like a different episode each week that looks at feminist solutions to climate change, and it feels like really positive to hear. Yeah, things have been developed and done and are in place. Like they might be micro, but you can do them. You can do them elsewhere. So I recommend that, and yeah, just working with artists is always brilliant for like just coming up with, and writers just sort of being able to, I think visioning is really important. So it's a combination of being able to do super super practical things and take those steps and know that you know what your next practical step is. I guess that's not big picture thinking, but it needs to be done. But then what you need is people who are visioning different futures, and there are no better people than artists and writers for creative visioning of different futures. So it's a sort of the big and the small picture together makes things feel, yeah, actually hopeful and exciting as well to be doing things differently than we're doing things now, and to have a small kind of like a small microcosm of a world where we are doing things differently. I think we practice different economies and different methods and things here, and there's lots of people doing that all over the world, as the Mothers of Invention podcast is evidence, but there'll be lots more of it.
I'm
so
going to have to check that one out.
It's a good podcast.
I would just add that as well, like, I do find inspiration in the work that's been done by like the team before I've joined and since I've joined. I'm just always amazed by what has been achieved by such a small organisation with relatively limited resources, and I think sometimes we forget, yeah, what we have done, what we've put in place, how far we've moved forward, and yeah, sometimes that just gives you a real boost of inspiration as well to keep on working and know that you can actually like affect some change, like it is happening.
Amazing. I'll definitely be checking that podcast out as well. That sounds great. Well, thank you so much to Jenny and Caroline for coming on to talk about green issues at GWL, and to Becky and Fee for doing the sound and editing. Join us next episode. We'll be talking about the theme of LGBTQ+.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the GWL at 30 podcast series. For more information about our Three Decades project, see our website and stay tuned for our next podcast.